This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The mutiny on the ship The Bounty is a tale told in several movies, but many people don't realize that the story is based on a real event, and that Fletcher Christian and his fellow mutineers fled with some Tahitian women to a remote island in the South Pacific. They never left, and the descendants of Christian and his mates still live on Pitcairn Island, which has come to be regarded by many as a tropical paradise. But my guest, journalist Kathy Marks, said there was a dark and sinister side to the Pitcairn community. In 2000, allegations surfaced that men on the island had been sexually abusing young girls there, perhaps for generations. The sensational accusations touched most of the families on Pitcairn and led to trials on the island, which previously had never even had a jail. Among those accused was Steve Christian, the mayor of Pitcairn and a descendant of Fletcher Christian. Marks, a correspondent for the London-based Independent newspaper, was one of only six journalists who covered the trials. In her book, Lost Paradise, Marks tells the story of the extraordinary case and considers what the disturbing events in the isolated community tell us about human nature. She spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Kathy Marks, welcome to Fresh Air. You described Pitcairn Island at one point in the book as the remotest inhabited place on Earth. Describe this island and its isolation.
It is an incredibly isolated place. I think what brings that home to you, first of all, is the difficulty in getting there. Pitcairn in 2009 still has no airstrip, not even a safe harbour. I travelled there from Australia. It took about a week to get there.
A series of flights
from Australia, followed by a very rough 30-hour boat voyage from a distant corner of French Polynesia. Now, having made that rather grueling journey, you then anchor about a mile off Pitcairn and wait for the island's men to bring out the longboat. That's the only way of getting on and off the island still, is the traditional boats that the men steer. What I found curious when I first arrived in 2004 to report on the first trials of Pitcairn men, the islanders brought out their longboat. It drew up alongside us, and I was quite astonished. I looked down and saw that the two men who were driving the longboat were two of the men who were about to go on trial for very serious child sex offences. And I thought, gosh, this is going to be quite an unusual assignment, and this is quite an unusual place.
And the population is what, around 50 or so?
It is just over 50, I believe. Yes, it ebbs and flows, but it's around 50.
Now, the inhabitants of the island, many of them are descendants from the mutiny on the Bounty, which, of course, was a mythic tale on the high seas, which is memorialized in several Hollywood films. And probably a lot of people don't realize that it's actually based on a real story. Briefly, recount the story of the mutiny on the Bounty and its connection to the inhabitants of Pitcairn Island.
Well, William Bligh, Captain William Bligh of the Royal Navy, had been given a command by the then King of England to go and collect breadfruit from Tahiti. He took a ship full of men on HMAV Bounty, and William Bligh's crew got quite friendly with the local women and loved the place and its beautiful environment, beautiful women and so on. After they left, a number of the men mutinied, led by Fletcher Christian, overthrew William Bligh, put him out in a small boat, and commandeered the Bounty. Now, the mutineers then went back to Tahiti and actually kidnapped some of the local women, a dozen or so, and took them off with them on their journey, on their quest for a hiding place.
After Fletcher Christian and the other shipmates took the vessel, the Bounty, from Captain Bligh, they were, in effect, fugitives on the high seas. And so they find this tiny little uninhabited island, Pitcairn, which was very, very, very small. They ditch the Bounty and burn it right there in the harbor.
That's right. They burnt the Bounty off the coast of Pitcairn in order to cover their tracks completely. Of course, that meant that they were then marooned on the island. There was no way they were ever going to get off. So that was their choice, that they were going to be forever outlaws and they were going to start a new life, a new society, truly in the middle of nowhere, truly away from the outside world.
And so you had a handful of Englishmen, Fletcher Christian and his fellow mutineers, and some Polynesian women. And as the story unfolds in the years afterwards, they fell into fighting amongst themselves, right?
That's right. There were 9 mutineers led by Fletcher Christie, and there were also half a dozen Polynesian men they took with them, and there were a dozen Polynesian women whom the English men took with to be their so-called wives. Now, there weren't enough women to go around, so the early history of Pitcairn is actually very violent. Within 10 years of these people settling on the island, all but one of the men was dead, and the vast majority were killed in fights over women, who was going to have which woman and so on. So you've got that very violent early history. That was then followed by a period when Pitcairn seemed to become a very Christian society, led by John Adams, the one surviving male who was one of the mutineers. He claimed that he'd converted to Christianity, having found a Bible in the wreck of the Bounty, and he was so moved by what he read inside the Bible that he then converted and persuaded everyone else on the island to follow suit. And when the island was finally then rediscovered by visitors, by a series of ships, captains who passed by and chanced across the island, they found and then later described to the outside world this incredibly Christian, pious society with morals of the highest order and so on. So that was how Pitcairn was seen, really, for a couple of centuries until the recent stories came out that then gave a very different image of the place.
But so you have this place that for 200 years has been inhabited by the descendants of Fletcher Christian and his co-mutineers and these Polynesian women, right? Now, tell us a little bit about it is an incredibly isolated place. What do the people on the island do for a living? And do they have electricity and television and alcohol and cigarettes and other things that you see in Western society?
Well, they have quite a few of the trappings of Western society in terms of ovens and beautiful kitchen equipment and stereos and DVD players and so on. Until recently, electricity was an issue. They had diesel generators and they only had electricity for 10 hours a day. That is still the case, in fact. Electricity is rationed. Until recently, and certainly when I was there in 2004, there was no television. There were no telephones. You could barely get shortwave radio. I mean, if you wanted hot water, you have to make a fire. There's only one shop on Pitcairn, which opens very intermittently, about 3 times a week for just an hour. So everything comes in by ship. It goes into this little shop, and over the course of the next weeks and months, the supplies run down until the next ship arrives. So in some ways, life is quite basic. On the other hand, the Pitcairners do make quite a good living from various sources. Now, the main one is because there's such a lot of interest in Pitcairn around the world, and that's because of the very romantic story we've been talking about, the mutiny on the Bounty, the fact that the island is still populated to a large extent by descendants of the mutineers. Pitcairn souvenirs, T-shirts, the stamps were always very highly sought after. The Pitcairners make wooden carvings, all these things they used to sell by mail order and now over the internet. And they also sell them. Cruise ships come to Pitcairn in the summer and people come ashore and buy things. And the last thing is that people on Pitcairn, it's an incredibly fertile place. It's a volcanic island. You can grow just about anything there and people do.
Well, Kathy Marks, let's talk about this child sexual abuse case which rocked the island and got such international attention and which you covered. First of all, let's just clarify, who governed the island? What was its connection to British law?
Well, Pitcairn, for about 150 years, had been a British colony. So it was a sort of long-distance British governing. The governor or one of his officials would visit the island very occasionally and the islanders would smile and behave nicely, and the governor would give them some kind of gift, like a piece of furniture, and then everyone would say goodbye, and that would be that for sometimes a few years, sometimes 10 years. Early in the 20th century, I think a good 20 years or more went by without anyone visiting.
But in effect, you have a British possession, which is really isolated and which is run by the islanders themselves, really, isn't it?
That's correct. The islanders did run their own affairs through an island council. They elected their own magistrates, police officers, and so on. These people were not trained. They were obviously related to just about everyone else on the island. So law and order was not exactly as we know it in other parts of the world.
Right. So you have an isolated island, which essentially governs itself in this small community. How did the sexual abuse first come to the attention of outside authorities?
Well, there were things that were known about for many, many years and decades, but it was not until 1999 that it kind of burst into the open, as it were. Now, what happened then was an English policewoman was posted to the island on a short-term posting for a few months to do some training with the locals. And while she was there, the policewoman, Gail Cox, was confided in by a 15-year-old schoolgirl who I've called Belinda in my book. That's obviously a pseudonym. What Belinda told Gail Cox was that when she was 10, she'd been raped by two local men, and that a number of other incidents of abuse and assault had also taken place, starting when she was about 5 or 7 years old. Now, Belinda was the first person ever to speak to someone involved with the law or the police service. And these were obviously incredibly serious allegations. So they were reported to the British authorities. The British authorities brought in detectives who began to investigate. And pretty soon they found out that unfortunately, Belinda was not the only alleged victim. There were dozens and dozens of victims who were now living all around the world because they'd grown up on Pitcairn, but they'd left the island. They were living in New Zealand, Australia, the UK. One was in Los Angeles.
There's a fascinating moment in the narrative at which it's clear that there's a wider problem here. And you describe this as there are these two detectives, Peter George and Robert Vinson, who go to talk to one of the men accused of having assaulted one of these young women, Sean Christian. And they say, well, they had underage sex with another woman who you call Catherine. They go and talk to Catherine. And what does Catherine tell the detectives?
Well, what she said was, I can't help you with what you're investigating, as in those specific allegations made by Belinda. But what I can tell you is that when I was a child growing up on Pitcairn, I was raped by Belinda's father. And she went on to tell the detectives, basically, this is the norm, this is the way of life, and that you won't get a girl on Pitcairn who reaches the age of 12 or 13 who's still a virgin. And everyone knows about it, but no one does anything about it because that's just the way life is on Pitcairn. So at that point, these two British police officers realised that there was a wider problem that needed to be looked at.
Now, when you arrived in 2004 to cover this incredible trial of Pitcairn men for child sexual abuse, you were one of six reporters who were there to cover the case. And you arrive, and as you say, the ship has to dock offshore, and a longboat from the island is rowed out to the – or I guess it's motorized now, but it comes out to the ship and fetches you and brings you ashore. And the first day, you were invited to meet with some of the women on the island, you and the other reporters there to cover the trial. What was their purpose?
Well, it was a very, very bizarre experience. You're right, we were invited to a meeting of the island's women at Big Fence, which was the house of Steve Christian, the island's mayor, and also one of the defendants who was about to go on trial.
And a descendant of Fletcher Christian, right?
And the descendant of Fletcher Christian. Now, when we got to Big Fence, we found pretty much all of the adult women on the island gathered there to speak to us. And what they wanted to tell us was, with these trials of seven men just about to start, it was all a load of rubbish. No one had ever been abused on Pitcairn. No child had been raped. No girl had been abused. They told us the whole thing had been made up by the British government, that there was a hidden agenda, which they believe was that Britain wanted to close down the island. It was a drain on the British purse. Britain could no longer be bothered maintaining this very remote and expensive colony. We asked them, you know, what about these girls who were claiming that they had been very seriously abused by adult men when they were growing up over the course of years and decades going back in the history of the island. Well, we were told the girls had all made up their stories. Yes, there was underage sex on the island, but that was an island custom. It was just like the rest of Polynesia, they said. And the girls or the women who were about to give evidence had all been bribed to make up their stories. These were women, some of whose daughters had spoken to police. They said that the girls had led the men on, you know, that it was all the girls' fault. They were promiscuous, and that's the way Pitcairn girls are. But, you know, Dave, just even during that meeting, things didn't add up. There was a woman sitting near me, Carol Warren, and she said to me at one point, you know, someone tried it with me, and, you know, I knew it was wrong, and I just ran away. And then in the next breath, she was saying to me, oh, the girls have all made it up, you know, and my own daughter, you know, she's a silly idiot. I don't know why she spoke to the police. And she was just, you know, she's so forward, that girl, she led the men on. So I thought, well, you know, this doesn't quite add up. Here's a woman telling me that she was abused or she was the victim of an attempted assault. As a girl herself, I think she said she was about 7 or 8. And the next breath, she's saying that it's all nonsense. No one's ever been abused on Pitcairn. Mm-hmm. No one's ever been raped.
Apart from the content, what they were telling you, I'm wondering what kind of impression did you have of these women? I mean, just their general affect and demeanor. Did they seem any different from women that you would meet in Australia or New Zealand?
They were pretty feisty women, which, you know, makes you think as well, because if these are Pitcairn women, then, you know, why have they allegedly spent generations being abused by men? Pretty feisty, quite funny, you know, there are a lot of laughing, sort of quite crude, you know, a lot of sort of sexual talk and laughter about sex. The thing that struck me most, I remember, was that I felt that no one looked me in the eye directly. It was like they were sort of wearing, almost like they were wearing masks, you know. I felt that there was a real barrier and that no one was really speaking directly.
Now, as the accusations emerged and the charges were filed and the trial approached, there became an energetic campaign on the island and around the world to paint the accused molesters as the victims. And of course, part of the argument was that there's this Polynesian culture of promiscuity and early sexual activity. But when you read these cases, it's not like these are close cases. I mean, these are children who were held and raped by much older men and clearly very, very traumatized by it. It raises the question of what about their parents? I mean, surely their parents must have known that this was happening. I mean, how did they react to these accusations? And I mean, were they shocked? Were they outraged? These were, after all, their friends and neighbors who had molested their children.
Well, their parents did know it was happening. And I believe that when the allegations emerged formally a few years ago, they were no surprise to anyone. Everyone who lived on Pitcairn over the years, over the generations, knew exactly what was going on. You've got a tiny community. What you've got is just about every man in that community who's offending. Now, their wives know what's going on. But what are you going to do if you're the mother of a girl who's being abused? What can you do that you can't? There's no one to complain to. The people in authority are doing it as well. Your own husband or brother is doing it. If you complain about someone else doing it to your daughter, then the whole place will collapse, because Pitcairn depends for its survival on male muscle power. It's a place where physical work is absolutely essential, or the place just cannot function. So this is a male-dominated society where men were doing exactly what they pleased. The women knew what was going on. They'd been victims themselves as kids. And incredible though it seems, with literally one or two exceptions, they did not raise a voice in protest.
You know, we should say that a lot of people from the island over time did emigrate, did leave and lived in New Zealand in particular. So there were women who fled and made lives elsewhere. We should move the story along and tell people about the trial. I mean, this was a trial before judges, not a jury, and was essentially a matter of the victim's word against the accusers. And the initial trial on Pitcairn Island was, I guess, what, 7 defendants or 9?
Yeah, it was actually 7 separate trials that were sort of running concurrently. So there was one case going on, but it was 7 discrete trials, with the victims giving evidence, not in person, but over a video link from New Zealand. In fact, nearly all the girls who grew up on Pitcairn did emigrate. You know, they left there as teenagers to go to school, to finish their schooling, and they never went back, not surprisingly.
So this must be a trial unlike any other. I mean, these terrible accusations in this tiny place. Give us a feel for what it was like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be fair to say that it was probably one of the most unusual trials in British criminal history, perhaps the most unusual. The trials that were held in a rather ramshackle community hall, which had in the past doubled as a courthouse, but hadn't been used for that purpose for a good 30 years or so. Now, what you had was a very incongruous sight of every day the lawyers and judges traipsing through the very rough, unsealed roads there, in their long black gowns, very formal British court attire, in contrast with the defendants who basically arrived in their usual gear, which was shorts and T-shirts and often barefoot. Now we're having these very harrowing allegations made by Videolink, by the victims in New Zealand. But, I mean, apart from the men who obviously had to be in court, none of the islanders were there to hear them. I mean, that was something that struck me day after day, was that the public seating in the court was empty. It was almost like the people of Pitcairn were pretending that the trials were not happening.
So the women tell their stories in this trial and then in a subsequent one in New Zealand that involved men who had been on Pitcairn but who were living abroad. What kind of verdicts were rendered and what kind of punishment was imposed?
Yeah, seven men went to trial on Pitcairn, and these were men who actually lived there. Six of them were found guilty. Subsequently, there were three trials that took place in New Zealand of men, Pitcairn men who lived in New Zealand or Australia. And of those three, two were found guilty and one pleaded guilty. So in the end, you've got 10 men who've been through the court system, nine guilty. Six of those men were given prison sentences. One was quite old. He was in his late 70s, and he was allowed to serve his sentence at home. The other five went to prison on Pitcairn, and I should mention that the sentences that were handed down were extremely lenient, some people would say. Normally, that kind of offending would result in 10 to 15 years in prison. These guys received a maximum of 5 or 6 years, and under the probation system, they were allowed to apply for parole after a third of that time and for home detention earlier than that. The result of all this is that 2 years on, that prison is now occupied by only one remaining inmate, Brian Young, and he's about to have a parole hearing, and by the time you go to air, he may actually be out of prison. So no one's been behind bars for more than 2 years. They've had fairly lenient sentences.
And that's for multiple child rapes.
Child rape. I mean, Steve Christian, for instance, he was convicted of 5 rapes. Brian Young, numerous rapes of 2 girls who were aged under 10. You know, we're talking very serious criminal offending here.
As you said, several men were sentenced to prison terms, but they ended up not serving very long, and they're now released, and the island goes on. How have the scandal and the trials changed Pitcairn Island?
In some ways, a great deal, mainly because the emergence of the scandal, I think, shamed the British government into realising that they had neglected this place for 2 centuries and that they'd better do something about it now. In a material sense, firstly, a lot of the infrastructure has been upgraded. The roads, one of the roads has been sealed, and they've got a rebuilt jetty and so on. So that side of things, plus communications, they have now got television, including CNN. They've now got telephones, so they're not quite so isolated. And I think the British government is trying to sort of create a sort of tourism or ecotourism industry focused on Pitcairn to sort of try and make the place self-sufficient economically. On the other hand, I would say that things have not changed that much, because there is still a very strong sense of communal denial about the crimes that we know did take place there. The men who served their rather ludicrously short sentences still maintain to this day that they did nothing wrong. And the rest of the community, at least publicly, backs that up and says, you know, that the trial was a travesty of justice and, you know, a terrible episode in Pitcairn's history. But, you know, that they're sort of putting it past them now and getting on with their lives. So you don't get any sense that this very, you know, these momentous events of you know, holding these trials, because, you know, there was there were years of preparation. You know, the whole process took nearly 10 years. You don't feel that things have changed significantly. On the other hand, you know, my understanding is that privately, some of the women in particular, some of the older women who were present at that meeting we talked about earlier in the conversation, you know, are starting to admit, look, this did happen to me. Look, it was wrong. Children shouldn't be treated like that. I have been affected and so on. But I, you know, I think that probably in a very small way, things are changing below the surface.
Do you think the abuse continues or has it stopped?
I don't think the abuse continues right now, because once the allegations were first made, a few years back, the first thing that Britain did was to send police officers to the island and social workers and also a government representative. So for the past 10 years, there's been quite a number of outsiders on the island, and I don't believe that any of the men there would be so silly as to engage in that kind of behaviour when they are being supervised so closely. However, I also believe that if those outsiders were to go away tomorrow, that behaviour would start again straight away, because it's ingrained in the mentality of the men of Pitcairn that this is an okay thing to do, you know. There's nothing wrong with it, and, you know, that's what you do if you can.
Steve Christian, who was one of the defendants, now out of jail, is he the leader of the island again?
That's right. I mean, Steve's a man who's, I think, in about his middle, late 50s now. He's been the community leader pretty much since he was in his teens. He's a classic alpha male. You know, he's a little bit more savvy, I'd say, more self-confident than some of the islanders. None of them terribly well-educated, but I'd say that Steve has just got a little more nous than most. And, you know, for the past, 40 years or so, he's really been looked up to by everyone else in the community. You know, he's the person who keeps the place going. He knows how to get things done. He's got incredibly good practical skills. He was the chief supervising engineer. And, you know, he can mend or do just about anything with his hands. I was told one story about the islanders were coming back from visiting a ship in a longboat, very rough seas. And at one point, Steve realised that the boat's rope had got caught in a propeller, quite dangerous situation. Evident that he'd jumped overboard, cut the rope, and was back in the longboat before most people had even realised anything was amiss. So that's the kind of bloke he is. Smart, self-confident, and I think with an enormous sense of entitlement. Steve, I think, you know, during the trials, I could see Steve Christian couldn't quite believe that this was happening. This was his rock, his island, his little empire. You know, all these outsiders were coming in, and everything was out of his control for the first time in his life. And I mean, he almost sort of cracked up in front of us as the weeks went by in a gradual way. So that was just an interesting thing to observe, I guess. You know, someone who had always had their own way and done what they wanted, taken what they wanted, and very much sort of benefited from the fruits of the island and, you know, the interest of outsiders, was suddenly not in control, was on trial, and, you know, did eventually go to prison. Having said that, he's now out, and, you know, although he's not allowed to hold a public position again for a while, you know, he will be able to soon, and there's no question that he will be re-elected mayor or whatever, you know, the community leader leadership position becomes empty.
Well, Kathy Marks, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Kathy Marks spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Marks is the author of Lost Paradise. Dave is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Bea Arthur died of cancer Saturday at the age of 86. We're going to listen back to an interview with her. In the New York Times obituary, Bruce Weber described her as having used her husky voice, commanding stature, and flair for the comic jab to create two of the most endearing battle axes in TV history, Maud Finley in the groundbreaking sitcom Maud and Dorothy in The Golden Girls. She won Emmys for both portrayals. Bea Arthur got her first big break as Lucy Brown in the first American production of the Threepenny Opera. I spoke with her 2 years ago after the DVD release of Maud, so we started with a clip from it. Maud was often topical, dealing with race, the war in Vietnam, and most famously, abortion. This scene is from the double episode in which the 47-year-old Maud is shocked to learn that she's pregnant. She doesn't want to have the baby. It's too late in her life and too medically risky. But she assumes her husband Walter does want the baby because he's never fathered a child. She's considering having the baby for his sake. Walter tells Maud that he's going to have a vasectomy so they can avoid getting into this predicament again. It turns out he can't go through with a vasectomy, but he doesn't have the courage to tell her. In this scene, they're in bed playing cards. She's just told him she's worried that if something ever happened to her, he wouldn't be able to father a baby because of the vasectomy.
Now, wait a second, Maud. Were you having the baby because you thought I wanted it? Well, you do, don't you? Sweetheart, would it disappoint you too much to learn that becoming a father was never one of my life's ambitions? I don't know why. For years, I used to feel guilty about it. For years, people told me I was nuts or selfish. How could I not love kids? Well, I do love kids, but they don't have to be mine. That's probably the worst confession I'll ever make. Do you hate me?
Of course not, darling. I love you. I love you, and I love my life.
Jen.
I take it all back! What are you trying to do to me? I don't even have time to sort my cards, and you're ginning out on me.
Forget the cards, Maud. We have something much more important to talk about.
What, you finally decided you do want a pickle?
Maud, I want you to have whatever it is you want. Does that include the baby?
Well, it did when I thought you wanted it.
Well, Maud, I think it would be wrong to have a child at our age.
Oh, so do I, Walter. Oh, Walter, so do I.
We'd make awful parents.
Oh, impatient, irascible.
Awful. It's just not our time
of
life.
Well, for other people it might be fine, but for us, I don't think it would be fair to anybody. Oh, Walter, hold me closer.
Are you frightened, Maud? About the operation, I mean.
Oh, don't be ridiculous, darling. Why should I be frightened? Were you frightened of the vasectomy? I said, were you frightened about the vasectomy?
It's an episode from Maud with my guest Bea Arthur and William Macy. And this was in 1972 when abortion...
35 years ago, yes.
Yeah, now abortion was legal in New York, but the Supreme Court had not yet ruled on Roe v. Wade. Maud was the first TV character to have an abortion. Bea Arthur, what was your reaction when you read the script?
Well, I tell you, when I first read the script, I wasn't that involved with the politics of the topic. I mean, I just read it and thought, my God, what a brilliant script. I just thought it was beautiful. I'm sitting here, and as I heard that scene again, I really got a little teary. It was beautiful. It was funny, but it was so beautiful.
So what kind of reactions did you get to this, both as a program and personally from people who you knew or met?
Well, I tell you, the mail was enormous, but I was never shown what we call hate mail. What I had seen was very intelligent, caring people who voiced their displeasure and explained why. And I think it was the first time I had ever even thought about it, because I came from a very small town on the eastern shore of Maryland, and when anybody got pregnant, the thing was to have an abortion. Of course, it was not legal, but that's what everybody did. I mean, I never had an abortion, but I suddenly thought of why it's very painful.
I want to play a scene from The Golden Girls, and in case anybody doesn't know what that series was, you were in your 50s for this series and lived in Miami in a house with your mother, who was in her mid-80s, and your two other single women friends. And in this scene, you've just ended your therapy with your ex, Stan, and you've agreed not to see each other for a couple of years. So you're back at home with your women friends telling them how happy you are to be done with Stan. Here's the scene.
I tell you, I am still stunned. I mean, I just can't get over that Stan is gone forever. I'm finally free.
Really?
Oh, and I feel great. As a matter of fact, a toast.
Okay.
To finality and closure. To husbands being out of our lives and gone forever.
Oh. Dorothy!
Wait, this is good. I mean, don't cry. Why are you crying?
Our husbands are dead, you monster.
I'm sorry. I mean, I didn't mean it that way. Oh, come on now. Let's celebrate.
Celebrate? You don't know what it's like to have a husband die and leave you with nothing. Just a closet full of suits that you spend the rest of your lonely life trying to get rid of. What are you anyway, a 42 regular?
Look, I'm sorry if I seemed insensitive, but in every relationship, there are always times when you don't want to be with each other. I mean, Stan and I went through a period where we had no marital relations at all. I totally cut off his sex.
You mean it grows back?
It's an episode of The Golden Girls with my guest, Bea Author, along with Rue McClanahan and Betty White. Were you able to get away with a lot of sex jokes on The Golden Girls because it was about older women?
I guess so. I guess so. It's the first time you saw women, I hate that expression, of a certain age, well-groomed and having active sex lives and great earrings, I remember. And the reason I stumble when I ask that question is because when I first read the first script, I thought it was one of the funniest, most adult, intelligent scripts I'd ever read. I never even stopped to think, hey, these are older women. It just seemed very funny to me.
Let's go back to the very start of your career. You were in the famous 1954 production of the Three Penny Opera, which was the first English production of the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht musical, translated by Mark Blitzstein.
It was the first U.S. production.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to play like a fantastic duet from this 1954 cast recording with you and Joe Sullivan, who later became Joe Sullivan Lesser when she married the songwriter Frank Lesser. And this is just a fantastic recording, and you sound great in it. Let's hear it.
Come on out, you gutter lily, you. Show your legs and let's all see how pretty. I'm always glad to admire beauty. They're the thickest ankles in the city. You thought you could make a big impression on my Mackie.
Didn't I?
Guess you never met his old friend Jackie.
Didn't I?
Well, you kind of make me laugh.
Who would kind of make you laugh?
Who would want a stupid cat?
Who would want one stupid cat?
How, now there's a leg for you, so Mackie needn't beg for you.
Well, you better ask him.
Yes, you better ask him.
You better ask him.
You better ask him. Ha, 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 ha.
That's my guest, Bea Author, along with Joe Sullivan, now Joe Sullivan Lesser, from the 1954 cast recording of the Three Penny Opera. Bea Author, what's your favorite memory of performing in that show in 1954?
It was very, to this day, it's the most exciting moment of my life. I walked into stage left, and I started singing, and my first lyrics were, I used to believe in the days I was pure, and the audience started laughing, and I thought, why the hell are you laughing at me? And then my next line was, and I was pure, like you used to be, and they laughed again, and I suddenly thought, hey, that's what comedy is. It's being true to what you are playing. And you must never show people that you're trying to be funny. There's a reality and an honesty. And it made my life, because prior to that, I had never attempted comedy. I always pictured myself as, not as a tragedian, but certainly as a very tall, very young leading woman.
Well, Bea Author, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Bea Author recorded in 2007. She died of cancer Saturday at the age of 86. The book jacket of George Shalaba's new collection of essays and reviews identifies him as a book columnist for the Boston Globe and as a freelance critic whose work is admired by a small circle of discerning readers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan thinks it's time that circle got bigger. Here's her review of Shalaba's book, which is called What Are Intellectuals Good For?
Some years ago, when at last I'd finished my belabored dissertation and got my PhD in literature, a relative of mine congratulated me by asking, "So, are you finally making any money now?" It's that kind of attitude, the all-American pragmatism that needs to attach a bottom-line value even to ideas, that prompts the title question of George Shalaba's new collection of essays and reviews called What Are Intellectuals Good For? The national tendency to equate the term intellectual with ineffectual hits Shalaba where he lives. Shalaba is one of the last of the free-range eggheads, a nearly extinct breed of public intellectual not affiliated with think tanks or ivory towers. Granted, he graduated from and has long been employed by Harvard, but as a clerical worker, not a faculty member. In his free time, Shalaba writes acutely about literature and politics and ethics. I first came upon his byline in the Village Voice in the 1980s, and once you read one of his lively and learned review essays, you were always looking for more. These days you'll find him in The Nation or The Boston Review or in those little avant-garde journals like N Plus One that celebrity public intellectuals like Christopher Hitchens have left behind for the greener pastures of Vanity Fair and Hardball. This new Shalaba collection, What Are Intellectuals Good For?, has been published in a beautiful paperback edition by the tiny Pressed Wafer Press. No one could expect it to be a stealth bestseller. But if you're at all interested in 20th century thinkers like Noam Chomsky, Dwight MacDonald, William F. Buckley, Ellen Willis, and Christopher Lash, to name a few, and in the larger question of whether the world would be poorer if they'd never written a word, then you'll find Shalaba's ruminations here invigorating. In fact, just reading Shalaba's collection will make you feel smarter, even if it's not clear if those kinds of smarts have any direct social utility. Shalaba tries to get a handle on just what intellectuals do for civilization by delving into the work of great and allegedly great minds. In that latter category, critic Edward Said comes in for an especially droll and scornful attack because of what Shalaba sees as the damaging legacy of his writing. That is, inspiring this current generation of academics into deluding themselves that they're carrying out political work by teaching, say, post-colonialist critiques of Paradise Lost. If intellectual work matters, Shalaba implies, it has to matter in ways that run deeper than delusionary self-puffery. Lionel Trilling is one such thinker whom Shalaba prizes for something beyond the obvious. In his shimmering appreciation of Trilling, entitled The Liberal Intelligence, Shalaba says, "Though nearly everything Trilling wrote had an ultimate political relevance, almost nothing he wrote had an immediate political reference." Later in the essay, Shalaba tries to clarify what he means by that riddling statement by linking Trilling with the great Victorian culture critic Matthew Arnold and demonstrating how both men saw literature primarily in its moral aspect, as an agent for teaching discrimination, receptiveness, patience, magnanimity. That pronouncement surely serves as part of Shalaba's answer to what intellectuals, or at least some of them, are good for. But that pronouncement wouldn't carry much weight with my bottom-line-only relative and his millions of fellow citizens. Truth to tell, the audience for writers like Shalaba and the journalists and thinkers he admires here was always relatively small. Even in their post-World War II golden age, the New York intellectuals, Irving Howe, Mary McCarthy, Dwight MacDonald, and the rest of that crowd, weren't speaking to a fraction of the audience who was tuning into I Love Lucy. That's why it's something of a miracle that an independent public intellectual like Shalaba has managed to hang on. If you're one of the fit, though few, whose brain doesn't go into automatic snooze mode at the mention of the word intellectual, His pieces here are a pleasure to read, supple, accessible, and wide-ranging. Writing enthusiastically about the work of journalists Alexander Coburn and I.F. Stone, Shalaba says that, while they didn't create monuments of unaging intellect, they hemmed in everyday barbarism a little. That's a fine way to sum up Shalaba's own achievement. He's not a household name, his essays and reviews won't rock the world, and I doubt that they're making him a whole lot of money. But to those of us who follow his lonely patrols around the perimeter, his work hems in the everyday barbarism of mental laziness and moral evasion just a little.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed What Are Intellectuals Good For? By George Shalaba. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.